bad month. Welcome back to our speakers, and at this point I would like to see if anybody has a question for anyone. And I will, as you are thinking of one, I don't have any hands shooting up immediately. I have questions here, but mine are boring. Mine are boring, conference, stale, usual thing. So, seriously, then we have a question from this afternoon.
I have a very boring question this
morning. Fantastic.
So, I actually got a question towards Daryl, actually. So, I'm always intrigued when you look at your... I was looking at the example you talked about those guys who... They had the... I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but they came up with the heat...
The thermostat.
The thermostat. So, the problem they were trying to... The issues were people trying to be environmentally friendly and they were lazy.
Yes.
So I actually sort of intrigued myself. How do you come up with that? How do you actually get to the point where you say that those are the dimensions that you're trying to solve, should we say, or those are the dimensions that you're looking for previous experiences to try to help you come up with a solution? I mean, how do you dissolve all of the issues that are probably there to come up with a...
Yeah, I think a lot of the answer to that, I mean, it was great watching Tony Fidel go through that process. Yeah, it was about 3 months getting from EcoBad, which is where he started, through to this may be a thermostat. I think there's a lot in what Dave was talking about, which was actually going on inside Tony Fidel's head. I think that idea of good people do things for a good reason and a real reason, that's a strong driver. So. What's always fascinating for me about Apple is they start in that intangible world. Get that stuff right first, and you've got a much greater chance of success. But ultimately, you've got to get both sides of the equation. So I think how do I get to the energy part was, okay, well, people say they care about the environment, they're not prepared to do anything. How can I manifest an actual benefit in the environment? And I think it was then just a case of looking around people's lives and saying, okay, where does waste occur? And where can I impact on that waste?
Okay. Daryl, can I follow up a bit? In the UK, in food labelling, we're kind of seeing green, orange, and red, about based on the amount of fat and stuff like that. I mean, was that another attempt to sort of be innovative with the consumer and nudge to the right sort of behaviour, and how's that working out?
I don't spend much time in the UK, so yeah. I'm not probably the best person to ask, but I would say that's one of the things that the agencies have failed to make go viral. But one that has gone viral, I think, is five a day. Just a very, very simple message for the consumer that says it's a really good idea to have five portions of fruit and vegetable in a day.
Or horse meat content.
Or horse meat, yeah. Horse meat is one of those, officially one of those five now. but I think, again, those kind of things tap into some of those good reason, real reason things that drive people. And if we look particularly at the real reasons, there just aren't that many of those motivators and demotivators in our life. Yeah. And what companies like Apple have done and successful agencies have done is codify them. Yeah.
Another question?
Yeah, I have a question for Dave. If you're collecting micro-narratives for a clustering exercise to use SenseMaker, but you didn't really mention it. But how many micro narratives do you need to collect?
We've had projects where we've had value from 14, projects where we've had 500,000.
Right.
Anecdotally, I haven't proved this here. I think stories are fractal. So they're self-similar. So if you gather the stories in the right way, a small number of stories have very similar patterns to a large number of stories.
Right.
And you're getting a large number really to increase the authentication.
Okay.
So it manifests in different ways. But the other thing, remember also, you're trying to move into continuous capture. So some of the work we're doing with field engineers, for example, is okay, yeah, you have to keep your field notebooks up to date. Right. Well, use your field. Use the software for field notebooks, because we can take pictures, we can have voice, you can type in, and we can have other fields. But then there's a tick box which says this is an anomaly, this is a suggestion, this is a report. Because what I want is every time they see something which is a little bit unusual or where they think there could be a good idea, I want to gather those. Because the problem with traditional suggestion schemes is they're too chunked and it takes too much time to process. And the same with anomaly reporting. People don't report anomalies early because each anomaly will have to be investigated. So these are called micro-anomalies, micro-suggestions that are only investigated when a pattern emerges in them, which means it's time to take the idea forward. So what you're really into is not so much just about the worry, you're moving into continuous flow-based capture, using naturalistic processes which people find convenient, rather than a traditional KM thing, which is, we need you to do this because in 3 years' time you'll get the benefit from it. Well, people have been there too many times before. I mean, my old rule on KM was never ask somebody for 5 minutes without giving them half an hour back. And then and there, not in the future.
Question for Dion. There's a YouTube educator. His name's CGP Gray. He's a teacher and he does these educational videos. And he was saying that education is time is just packed. And the one thing, someone asked him what would be the one thing that you would drop, and he said language courses. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think people always converse best in their own language. They always absorb most information in their own language. So I was talking to a gentleman earlier who spoke French, a bit of Chinese, a bit of Japanese, but he even concurred with me that even though he's quite fluent in French, he would absorb more if he read it in English. So I think language still is key. Even if it's not perfect English, it's your mother tongue and you understand and absorb far more detail than you would in a second or third language.
It also makes a difference when you learn it. Yes. When I was growing up, my parents spoke German, Welsh and English. But they were told to only speak one language to their children. Because the conventional wisdom was that, and actually that was exactly the wrong thing to do. Particularly for somebody like me who was dyslexic, because picking him up later was almost impossible. Because actually, up till about 3 or 4, the brain can handle 4 or 5 languages being spoken, it can sort them out. Yeah, so actually, it's exposure early. Because the brain's very plastic up until about 2 or 3 or 4, then it starts to narrow down. Yeah, so up until 2 or 3, you can hear 800 sounds. By the time you're 3 or 4, it's going down to about 120 if you haven't heard the others.
Yes. David, Craig asked you the question yesterday. Yes,
I didn't answer it properly then.
I think because when I'm reviewing my material for some of the other law enforcement on the Asian capturings, I think I just want to ask about the micro narrative. Instead of just looking at how people speak and text, can we just monitor how they behave? Say like their location of their mobile phone, their GPS areas, their frequency of their text messaging.
I think it has value, but the more they know you're doing it, the more problems you've got.
So still have look at the way they speak, their contact.
Yes and no, all right. I mean, I wouldn't say against that, but let me give an example, all right? So medical data, where we're doing a lot of work at the moment. So people on chronic pulmonary care regimes, where they're on machines, they're having to take drug regimes. By actually getting them to tell a story every time they feel pain or every time something bad happens, yeah, we can actually account for the anomalies and the stuff you're talking about, which is all the stuff we can report independently.
Okay.
And that actually aids hugely. But I think the other problem you've got is a much more political one. People are just starting to wake up to the fact that everything they do is being monitored. And that's going to produce a really nasty backlash. Sooner or later, something bad will happen.
Okay.
Yeah, and you're going to get all sorts of problems with legislation and everything. Right? The nice thing about narrative capture is it's purely voluntary. So everything is voluntary and everything is visible at the time it's captured. Yeah, so it doesn't feel like the spooks.
Okay.
Yeah, in that sort of sense. The other thing is be aware it's been gamed. I mean, one of the issues on counterterrorism is that the minute the US started to use social network analysis to identify how Al-Qaeda was done, because they're only rewarded if they publish papers, they published papers, Al-Qaeda read the papers and started to manipulate the data to get the right result. Right? I mean, and anything explicit will be gamed. Yeah, and we can already see that. Twitter is actually a real problem at the moment because it's been gamed. Yeah, large companies can do it, and respondents are quite clever. And American Airlines are brilliant. I mean, I'm the executive platinum dog that's 70 million miles. If I tweet something, they get back to me within 2 minutes. Because they've got all their high-status frequent flyers and Twitter on monitor alert. because they actually know if I tweet something bad, it will go around quickly. But if they then respond to me, like they did with Netgear the other day, I'm really happy. So they get damn sight more marketing out of that. So that type of highly proactive personal marketing works, I think, in social computing. But the monitoring sinister big brother monitoring what's going on, I think there's a lot of big data people who are just creating, they're digging a big pit for themselves at the moment.
I might add a little bit to that too. We've just added BPM to our platform, so you can drag and drop workflow and so on, but it's specific to linguistics and language. So you're monitoring a Twitter feed, like you just talked about, you can drag and drop sentiment analysis in to give it a scale of 1 to 5. Okay, now, different purpose than what you're talking about, but the goal is to understand how Nike is with their latest shoe in Korea versus China and how that's being received. Now, maybe some people know, maybe some don't. Today, I just assume that somebody's watching if it's posted online. The only real way to keep privacy is don't post it. Right? That's the reality. But
there's another thing which is important here as well is, I mean, we do a lot of work with what we call fitness landscapes. So what we do is, the stories is their index, they're presented as three-dimensional landscapes in which the sort of white pattern, if you've ever seen the sort of cosmology, you know, physics-type pictures where gravity wells here, you get a white grid distorted. The heavy distortions represent dominant patterns in the stories. The weak distortion represents areas where you could achieve change. But then we put yellow dots for all the stories which don't fit the pattern. So the brain is now looking at the big picture, but also sees the exceptions on one screen. And people go to the exceptions. Because, and the, again, the trouble with the big data approach is they're giving you average stuff. What you really want is something which says big picture and anomalies at the same time, because the anomalies are where you can get strategic advantage.
Right.
Please. I've got a question for Dion as well. To talk about machine translation, about two things. Do you see in the next few years, some of these are actually empowering consumers, general consumers, customers, to use them either free or paid for service? That's the first one. The second one you also mentioned about, and I agree, the best approach is a human-machine cooperative approach. But you didn't say that whether you know you would ask the machine to pass this paragraph or these few paragraphs and then pause and ask the human to verify indeed this is what it means, or you ask the whole lot and then generate a set of questions for the human to sort out and then direct the machine to do it again. Right. So thank you.
Okay, so the first question, the machine translation tools are today focused on the consumers. Google Translate, Bing Translate, that's the leading spot. The reason's very simple. They're not, or haven't been, good enough for commercial application. You couldn't trust them. You know, they're great for getting an understanding of what something else says, but would you hold that translation up in a courtroom? Absolutely not. Right? So they're good enough at a gist level or a general understanding level. Where companies like myself are getting involved now is the next level, where it's customized translation. So customizing for medical versus antivirus. I wouldn't use an engine customized for antivirus to translate medical documents. You have a totally different context, misrepresentation, all sorts of things go wrong. Okay, so the next stage there is, you know, having the tools for business that enable the machine-human relationship, where there's already professional translation companies that have hundreds of thousands of people freelancing globally. They talk about crowdsourcing. This is the original crowdsourcing. There's very few professional translators that work for one company full-time compared to those that freelance for 20, 30, 50, 100 companies. So they all draw on different language service providers. They have their pool of freelancers, and whoever wins the job gets the freelancer this week, right? But you machine translate, then there's workflow tools that go out to the human, post-edit, it comes back. Now we're getting more advanced with terminology lock-in, so IBM prefers these terms, Microsoft prefers these terms, they mean the exact same thing, but this is our flavor of writing, right? Particular writing style, more complex logic, so we do travel reviews, and it'll translate a travel review and then look at the currency and say, well, that's euro, but my audience speaks US dollars, so I will do a real-time conversion going out to exe.com as part of the translation, get the exchange rate, click it in. Right, so it's all these extensions to translation that enable the human to do more, better, faster. And then now we're getting into the next stage, which is quality metrics. So we can even rank a human and a machine and say, how good are either or both or the same? Right. So is it a high quality translation or a low quality translation? Without even having the original material in some cases. Is it good grammar? Is it easy? Does it represent meaning? Well, that's a whole different thing. And language is idiomatic. But let me give you a simple one in English. When you say, like father, like son, you can translate that into Chinese, but the meaning is lost. Okay? The rough equivalent idiom in Chinese is a dog cannot give birth to a donkey.
See, quick question on that. I mean, if somebody in Britain says, from a certain generation, says ex-politician, they deliberately misspell. Can you pick that up?
We can.
Because it's a reference to Winnie the Pooh, and it actually has a whole complex sub-meaning under it. And English constantly references children's literature, if you look at it. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you...
In some cases, we train engines to understand flaw.
Okay.
So, right now we're doing travel reviews or customer support for Zinger. And, various different things where people spell things wrong, or patents are brilliant. They deliberately spell or transliterate things incorrectly so that you cannot find the patent and they can sue you later. Right? They make it harder to discover. So we have algorithms that help you find those anomalies and bring it back together.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Dave, sorry, on, because you mentioned about storytelling, mainly, example for medical practice in general. Do you think it's the same sort of patterns or any tips on how we can manage or implement storytelling in organizations, in a corporate society or
in what sort of an organization?
Financial organization, corporate, not...
Okay, well, let's take financial services, something we're talking about this week.
Yeah.
Producing new products for consumers is a constant iterative cycle. So that example I gave about, if you create a panel of your customers, so don't go and market research and say, this has actually been done by television channels for years, you're our panel.
Yeah, I'm referring, on the inside, organization story inside organization.
It's the same principle. It's more effective knowledge management. The other thing you're doing is you're trying to create a sensor network. So, for example, one of the things we're doing in Singapore is we're going to have within a few years 10,000 Singapore citizens keeping a daily diary of what it means to be a Singaporean. All right? And we can incentivize that with things like tickets to Singapore Idol, which, as I said to Les, I think is a punishment for some of the things that we want. National days. It's fairly easy to incentivize people to do that. Now, we're doing that because that potentially replaces market research, polling, and focus groups, because I've got a real-time continuous capture. So start to think about this with employees, employee satisfaction. But then I get a problem. I then activate the network to ask a question of it, and people index the problem. They don't know what the right answer is. So I've now got a real-time evidence-based approach for what's called whole workforce engagement. And we're already doing one project in Zurich, a financial services company, where we can actually, if the board gets into conflict over something, we break the problem up into three aspects. We distribute each of the three aspects to a panel of their expert staff. The expert staff index the aspect on four triangles. And then we present the results graphically to help the board make a decision. Right? So I call this, you create networks for ordinary purpose that you can activate for extraordinary need. And what you're doing is you've got your computers, your search engines, you're building, everybody's building that capability, but they're not building their network capability of their customers and their staff, who will actually be able to do a huge amount with very little investment, actually.
I'm Alex Fong from the Hong Kong Government Efficiency Unit. Well, from Mr. Campbell's speech, we know that HSBC have already implemented an electronic record keeping system. So how do you see the relationship between records management and knowledge management? Can you share with us HSBC's experience? Thank you.
Yeah, we made a decision last year that the records management function should or would be best suited fitting within the knowledge management construct. I think HSBC certainly is a little bit ahead of some of our other financial services counterparts in terms of understanding and mapping the regulatory environment in which that records management function exists. The complexity, I think, that was created by the regime that I inherited was simply trying to translate the vast number of categories that were created by that complex legal environment into some kind of massive system that would be delivered in a period of time, with a period of time being something like 3 years, and the price tag being something like $75 million. So, contrary to what you believe, the first thing I did when I took over the program was kill off that project. So no, we do not have an all-singing, all-dancing global system for records management, because I certainly haven't discovered one yet. And I don't think one actually exists. As anyone tells you it exists, they either don't know what they're talking about or they're lying. So instead we've changed tack, and we've begun to work very closely with our colleagues in IT under the close oversight of our records and information governance specialists to invest instead in upgrading the existing technologies and starting to create linkages between them, instead of wasting 3 or 5 years and $75 million, so we could get something that would be fit for purpose at that time.
That's really important wisdom, right? And I think governments need to pay attention to that. One of the biggest mistakes people have made is to put SharePoint in and assume they've done knowledge management. What they've done is weak records management. And if you actually, it's the same as the SAP mistake. It's putting in one big thing designed for the lowest common denominator approach, which then destroys adaptability. If you look at the big food retailers, these guys aren't stupid, they never did that. They kept multiple small systems so they could swap them in, swap them out. They took the interface overhead because it gave them resilience and adaptability. And yeah, there's this concept you can do one big thing, one size fits all. It's a very 80s concept in IT, and it's persisting long beyond its natural lifestyle. In fact, one of the tweets I gave at UKCare, which I probably shouldn't have, is, what was it? SharePoint is to knowledge management what Six Sigma is to innovation. Which got retweeted around the world within seconds and got me into some considerable trouble. I still think it's one of the best tweets I've ever done, to be honest.
Yeah, my insight is if you hear an IT presentation and the person says, we have the total solution, leave the room.
And he's an IT guy.
No, but I've never said we have the total solution, but you hear it a lot. We actually heard it yesterday in the Computer World CIO Forum.
That was your sales pitch at Gartner, wasn't it, Liz?
What?
Wasn't your sales pitch?
Hey, come on, that's a strike for you, all right? You can get up to me now.
I think you're still far ahead, Dave. Unfortunately, in addition to losing the room in about 4 minutes, we're deep, deep into happy hour. I'd like to invite our president back up with some closing comments. Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you.
Well, this isn't quite the end, because what I'm going to do now is sort of invite the speakers over the road to Grappers, which is a short distance away if anybody wants to continue a little bit of conversation, because it is rapidly approaching happy hour. But before I go, I mean, really, I want to thank you, the people who've come today, the people who've really funded this event. I hope you've got some value out of it. It's been very informally arranged. I mean, some of you, look at the admin side, are desperate for receipts. Please, I'm the point person on the HKKMS website. If you do need any paperwork very rapidly, please approach me. But thank you very much for funding it. I mean, I think we have some of the world's best thought leaders in the room with us. I hope you found it very stimulating. And I'd like any of your feedback as well. Do drop me a note if you have any comments. We will plan a session like this, and I think this format works reasonably well. It's informal. The room is broken up. There are a lot of conversations going on over lunch and at the breaks, which is an indicator to me that people are actually getting something out of it. We'll probably have another session like this in the September-October timeframe. And meanwhile, the Society will continue to run its monthly events. So stay tuned. Eric and I have got a pretty good program lined up. There's Professor Choi. I'm sure most of you know Professor Choi, and David Aguirre there from the Society here, and Jenny from the KMIRC. So your organizers are well supported in the room. Okay, thanks. So those of you with dry throats, Grappers is just in Pacific Place. Walk across the bridge. We'll continue there. Thank you.
One last thing before David shoots me. Dana's made accounts for everybody on the Society website, so contact him for the information if you already have it. You want to get some of the materials here, probably not Larry's, some of the materials available here, and some of the discussions, and anything that's recorded. So that's being available on the Society website. We don't want to make it open to the entire world, so you already have accounts made to get with David, and the organizers did it. Thank you.